This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the origins of the war in Ukraine and the role that the United States played in bringing that war about.
We speak with Medea Benjamin, a leader of Code Pink and an activist in the United States peace movement for many years.
We will also take a look at the growing assault on free speech and the growing amount of censorship in our nation today.
We're living, unfortunately, in a culture of repression and censorship. We're lucky to have our guest, Nadine Strossen, the former leader of the ACLU.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. You know, a clear majority of people in the United States support a woman's right to an abortion. And so with the news that Roe v. Wade is about to be overturned, the myth that this is a democratic country is further exposed as well, BS. Because in this capitalist, corporatist country where money decides who is elected and who gets to appoint the Supreme Court justices, the desires of the majority will mean nothing until and unless we make it mean everything. Listeners, if you're as angry about this shameful development as I am, then together we've got to pledge to do whatever it takes to reverse this barbaric, sexist, racist, and economically unjust decision. And to do that, we've got to do what we the people did 50 years ago to win a woman's right to choose in the first place. Remember, listeners, those 9 male Supreme Court justices who in 1973 reversed themselves and decided Roe v. Wade didn't simply wake up one morning and say to themselves, "Oh, damn, we've been a bunch of sexist pigs. What have we been thinking?" Why, of course a woman has the right to decide whether or not to abort her fetus. No, my friends, that's not what happened. What happened was that for years before those 9 men changed their minds and decided Roe, hundreds of thousands of women and the men who supported them took to the streets over and over again, demanding the right of a woman to choose. They marched, they sat in, they campaigned for enlightened politicians. They went on hunger strikes. They went to jail on behalf of their demand for the right to choose. Yes, and that's the only reason why those 9 male justices finally came to their senses and did the right thing. So, listeners, you and I and all men as well as all women who respect the reproductive rights of women must be in the front lines of the battle that now lies ahead. Yes, all of us who care about this issue must do all we can to reverse this terrible decision, this terrible news. We must join protests in the streets. We must march and keep on marching in ever greater numbers, over and over again, until once again the women of our nation have full reproductive rights, the same reproductive rights that women have in the more enlightened nations of this world. And so, let there be no peace in the streets until there is reproductive justice for our nation's women. Let there be no peace for any politician or in Congress until there is reproductive justice for our nation's women. And let there be no peace in the courts until there is that reproductive justice again for our nation's women. And so, dear listeners, today let us vow, let us pledge here and now, that there will be no peace in this nation until there is reproductive justice for all of the women of this nation.
The proxy war between the United States and Russia has been going on now in Ukraine, according to some opponents, since February. Others have argued it's been going on since 2014 with the USA organized coup, which overthrew the elected government of the Ukraine and replaced it with a government more favorable to the United States interests. The major news media in the USA have played down the role of the USA in the 2014 coup, which brought fascists into a European country's government for the first time since World War II. At that point, the coup government launched a military action against Russian-speaking population of the eastern Donbas region, which has declared its independence by a popular vote. So far, the military action of Ukrainian forces has resulted in 14,000 deaths. It is the position of many anti-war activists in the USA that the Russians were responsible for initiating the war by illegally invading Ukraine this past February. Other anti-war activists take the position that the Russians acted out of self-defense, considering what happened in 2014, and have refused to outright condemn the Russian invasion. This disagreement has caused a paralysis in the U.S. peace movement. The United States has supplied the Ukraine government with billions of dollars worth of weapons and has shown no inclination to support a ceasefire or a negotiated settlement. Some have observed that the USA will fight the Russians to the last drop of Ukrainian blood. The present danger of a nuclear conflagration between the United States and Russia is horrific. The world's two most heavily nuclear-armed countries have exacerbated this danger daily. The United States has now articulated its goal in the war to subjugate the Russians and possibly overthrow the Putin government. For its part, the Ukrainian government is under tremendous pressure from the right-wing forces in that country, the same forces that participated with rifle fire in the 2014 coup to not engage in peace discussions. The Ukrainian government is operating under martial law and has banned all opposition parties, including socialists, advocating for negotiations and peace. Repression in the Ukraine is being carried out by the SUB, the Ukraine Political Police, with likely advice from the CIA. What will it take to get anti-war people in the United States mobilized and acting together in a unified way? What demands should they raise? What can they do? We speak today with Medea Benjamin, a leader for many years in the U.S. peace movement and the co-founder of Code Pink, a major anti-war organization in our country. Medea Benjamin, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. Great to be on with you.
Without condoning its invasion, how do we understand the war from the perspective of Russia? To what degree was the crisis provoked by the behavior of NATO and the USA? And is NATO an aggressive military force?
Well, certainly NATO is an aggressive military force. You know, I keep hearing ad nauseum how NATO is a defensive alliance, which is just ridiculous when you look back, whether it's the bombing of Kosovo and then the invasion of Afghanistan. NATO was also involved in the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Then we have the invasion of Libya. So certainly from the Russian point of view, they're seeing an alliance that is very aggressive and has gone way beyond its original North American geopolitical region. Then in terms of its expansion eastward, I think your listeners have probably heard a lot about the broken promises that were made during the Bush administration and how the two different times of expansion led NATO right into borders of Russia, and how then the U.S. involvement in Ukraine and U.S. NATO involvement from the time of 2014 really made Russia feel that it was being surrounded. Russia feel that U.S. NATO forces were getting closer and closer, and that the U.S. was involved in turning around the government in Ukraine from one that was closer to Russia and the East to one that was Western alliance. So certainly we have to understand where Russia is coming from. As you implied in your intro, it's not to justify, it's to set the context.
Yes, and I wonder, Medea, whatever may have been the case initially, given the billions now that the U.S. has sent in terms of military hardware and other support that we've given to Ukraine, has this not now become a proxy war also between the United States and Russia? What are the implications of that?
Yes, and I think it is important to restate that the U.S. was not only involved in the expansion of NATO, but in supplying billions of dollars worth of weapons starting in 2014, involved in military exercises, involved in the Maidan coup. And so, you know, it has been a proxy war, and it's become more of a proxy war now. A very convenient one for the United States in terms of being able to condemn Russia for the brutality of the invasion, but on the other hand, not expose Americans to any physical harm, but to be fighting, as I say, to the last Ukrainian. Yes, it is a proxy war that is becoming clearer and clearer as the goalposts of the United States change from one of defending Ukraine to one of, quote, victory, winning, and then to one at weakening Russia. And now that that has become something that is not just quietly or not even voiced, but actually something that is being spoken right now, I think it is clearer and clearer that it is a proxy war to weaken Russia.
So what do you and Code Pink think peace organizations in the USA should be saying and doing?
Well, as you know, there's tremendous division among the peace organizations, and anything you say and do, you will be criticized by people and groups that are more to the left and more to the right. I don't know if left and right actually mean much these days, but I think it is important to be very out front about criticizing this invasion. And there are groups that don't want to do that. I think that's a big mistake. But then we do want to say that if you want to help the Ukrainian people, the best thing to do is not add more fuel to the fire, not supporting $20 billion worth of more weapons, but to ask why our government is not doing anything to call for negotiations. And when you heard early on after the invasion, Zelensky saying, well, maybe the dream of entering NATO is something we can't do, maybe neutrality is something that we need, there was radio silence from the U.S. and NATO. In fact, it was worse than that. It was more egging them on. And I think there is reason to believe that when Boris Johnson from the UK went recently to Ukraine, he too was saying, don't give up any territory, that, you know, we are in this with you until you win. I think that what we in the peace movement have to say is that there is no military solution. There is no winning in this horrific war. And we have to call on our, quote, leaders, whether it's Nancy Pelosi, who went to Ukraine and said, we're in this with you until we win, or whether it's General Austin, the Secretary of Defense, who is talking about weakening Russia, or whether it's Biden himself, who talked about how Putin must go. You know, that is not for the U.S. to determine. I think we should be supporting the anti-war movement in Russia, and we have reached out to them and are in constant dialogue with a number of different groups in Russia, trying to lend them at least moral support. And then it's important to build an international movement. We have been working with groups in Europe, like the Stop the War Coalition, the No to NATO group, the group called Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. We have done regular educational events with them. We've called for days of action. We have another one coming up May 7th that we're calling for people. If they can't do rallies because they don't feel that they have enough people in their communities that are ready to do that, then they should download a flyer or petition on our website called peaceinukraine.org and go out and educate people. I think education is probably the most important thing that we could do right now, because even people who have been part of a peace movement for decades are now saying we have to arm Ukraine, and that's just wrong.
Yeah, following up on that last thought, Medea Benjamin, and we've talked earlier in the show about how many billions are being sent and more on the table. And I know that is Code Pink's position. They're opposed to the what we're doing with respect to arming Ukraine. But if to the extent that we don't or haven't, wouldn't that have left or now leave Ukraine unable to fully defend itself against the Russian military invasion, which you also condemn?
Well, I think that our role as a peace movement is to say that we want our leaders to be sitting down with adversaries. You know, we don't need Pelosi and the others to be going to Kiev to have another photo opportunity with Zelensky. What we need them to do is talk to the Russians. And I think, look, if the U.S. had taken Russia's proposals seriously earlier on, including in December of last year when they had a 9-point proposal, that most of which were actually very logical things, I don't think this war would have happened. And right now, I don't think the role of the U.S. is to continue to pour more weapons in because we see what the result is and that more and more people are dying. I think their role should be to be sitting down at the table, or first of all, to be saying, what are the compromises that the U.S. and NATO are willing to make? Because I feel that they are stopping Zelensky from making those compromises. So our job is to call for Russian troops out, is to call for negotiations, is to be linking up with countries around the world that are trying to find solutions. I mean, the U.S. could be working with the Chinese and say, we need you to intervene with Putin to push for a negotiated solution. There are so many things that are not being done by our government that should be done that would bring a close to this war. Otherwise, we're going to see this drag on for years and years. Let's face it, the U.S. has been involved in the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq for like 2 decades. The U.S. keeps the war going in Saudi Arabia against Yemen for now going on 8 years. The U.S. Has no problem dragging this out, and in fact might want to keep dragging it out for the purpose of weakening Russia. If we want to see an end to the war, then I think we have to say weapons is not the way to do that.
Is it your opinion that perhaps the hidden agenda of the United States is regime change in Russia?
Well, I think the U.S. would love regime change in Russia, but I think that its agenda is more weakening Russia, not having a rival, either Russia or China. And we've seen in Pentagon papers for the last years that they wanted to get out of the Middle East so that they could focus on the rivals of China and Russia. I think many of us thought it was going to be China that was going to be the focus, but lo and behold, it is now Russia, and I think they want to weaken it to the extent that Russia cannot be a competitor on the global scale with the United States, and that Europe, it has to be more in the U.S. realm. I think, well, we know that there were many in the United States who were very unhappy with Germany because of its close trading ties, including the very big gas deal that they made with them. So I think it's both not weakening Russia and getting rid of a competitor and strengthening the U.S.-Russian alliance. I mean, the U.S.-NATO European alliance.
Yes, indeed. As I watch, you know, CNN and the rest of the news coverage and read it in the paper, and I don't mean to minimize the suffering. I mean, it's terrible, the suffering that's going on, but they're almost covering it like a soap opera. I mean, and we're seeing endless images, of course, of the terrible, terrible things that are happening to the people of Ukraine, what's happening to the infrastructure and all the rest. We hear a great deal about Russian war crimes. We don't hear anything about, of course, Ukrainian war crimes. But you can contrast the media coverage today, the corporate media coverage today, that is, of the war in Ukraine with how that same corporate media covered, the U.S. war in Iraq and Afghanistan, for example. And don't you think, Medea, that if they had covered those wars in the same way they're covering the war in Ukraine, the American people might have turned against those wars much more quickly than they did? as opposed to playing the role of really being propagandists for those wars. What do you think?
Absolutely. I myself went to Afghanistan right after the U.S. invaded, came back with tragic stories and videos and photographs of civilians who were killed, and the U.S. press was totally uninterested. They did not want to carry stories of civilian deaths. And that was basically the case for about the entire time of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And in Iraq, we have the horrific examples of entire cities like Mosul being decimated. We have the example in Syria, the entire city of Raqqa being devastated. And yet the American people didn't see those images. So I do wish that those wars had been covered the way this war is being covered, just like I wish the crisis of the refugees from the invasion of Libya or the other invasions that the U.S. has been a part of have been covered, like the horrific refugee crisis that we're seeing in the case of Ukraine.
Please talk to us about the danger of nuclear war. Shouldn't we be talking about implementing the 1970 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? The U.S. and Russians signed it and committed to complete nuclear disarmament.
Yes, I think both Russia and the U.S. have violated the Non-Proliferation Treaty that is supposed to move towards the elimination of nuclear weapons. And in the case of the United States, dedicating in the next three decades trillions of dollars to modernizing our nuclear weapons. And given that we're in such a dangerous situation right now with the prospect of nuclear annihilation, I think we should be inspired by the 40th anniversary of the gathering in New York City in Central Park, where a million people came out against nuclear weapons. We need to build some massive movement in the United States and globally. Now we have a treaty at the United Nations that bans nuclear weapons. We've got to get the nuclear countries to agree to that treaty. And certainly the peace movement at this time has to be educating people about the need to eliminate nuclear weapons and the need to build a massive movement to do that.
Medea, the press has either whitewashed or simply ignored some unpleasant facts about the nature of the Ukrainian government. There is no freedom of the press there. They have outlawed socialist parties and other opposition parties. They have suppressed those advocating for negotiations. We hear Putin, of course, talking about the Nazi influence or the neo-Nazi influence. Is he all wrong? What is the degree of right-wing and, in some case, fascistic influence in the Ukrainian government?
Well, we know that there has been an influence in the Azov Battalion being a fascist group, but we also know that only 2% of the vote was given to the neo-Nazi party in the last election. So I don't think we can say that it's a government that is full of neo-Nazis. But I do think this suppression of freedoms is something that unfortunately happens during wars, and we see it happening in Russia as well with the crackdown on the press there and the crackdown on protesters. And we see it here in the United States, where channels that were either from the Russian government or just journalists or social media people who had a different view of this war have been taken off the air. So in all of these cases, instead of allowing people to have a range of opinions to make up their own minds, what we see is the fog of war in terms of propaganda.
How can anti-war activists avoid being labeled as Putin apologists?
I think it is important to say from the start that we think this invasion is brutal, illegal internationally, and we believe the Russian troops must leave. Having said that, I think then it's easier for people to hear us when we talk about the other issues. And we also have to convince people that if you're here in the United States, we can't do a lot to influence the Russian government, but we should be able to influence our own government. And so here is where we have to put the pressure. So I have been going out and talking to a lot of people, and I find that when you start posing it in those terms, and when you pose it in the terms of, do you want to see this war drag on for years, or do you want to see it come to a quick end to save the lives of Ukrainians, then people are more open to talking to you about it without accusing you of being pro-Putin.
Medea, we've talked about this a bit already. You've indicated certain dates where protests are already scheduled. You've talked about petition drives and what have you. And further, in terms of what listeners can do to try to build a peace movement, given the certain amount of confusion that we've talked about that exists, any other thoughts on that? And do you think that as the war continues, it might be easier, sadly, if it continues, easier to arouse the American people to understand more fully what is going on and therefore take to the streets in the more traditional fashions that you and Code Pink and others have done in the past?
Yes, it's been hard to get people out in the streets in large numbers, but we have had rallies in about 125 cities. And we are now telling people to do these educational events either online or go out to their farmers markets or their federal buildings or their post offices to educate people. We're telling them to contact their congresspeople to oppose the $20 billion in more weapons to Ukraine and to separate that and be generous in terms of the economic aid and the humanitarian aid. We're also building our No to NATO coalition, which existed way before this. And when NATO is meeting in June in Madrid, there will be a alternative peace summit that will be happening at the same time that we will be live streaming globally. And then I think we have been engaged in a struggle that we have not made progress on, and that is the Pentagon budget. But we can't give up on that, because now with Ukraine, the administration and the Congress are throwing even more money, massive, massive amounts of money, into this Pentagon budget. And this affects everybody, whether they know it or not, because it means less money for everything else. And that, in addition to the fact that people are feeling the consequences of this war at the gas pump and with the higher food prices, I think will give us an ability to talk to people about not only the need to end the war, but how the U.S. massive military budget is not helping us. It doesn't help to win wars. We just had 20-year loss in Afghanistan that people shouldn't forget. So I do think that as this unfortunately drags on, people are going to be more and more open to hearing ways that they can stop the inflation at home and stop giving so much money to weapons and bombs that only serve to kill more people and create tremendous profits for a small number of weapons manufacturers, and instead invest that in the real needs of the people and the real existential threat of climate change.
Medea, before we have to say goodbye, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time. How can people contact Code Pink?
We have two ways that people can contact us. One is through Code Pink, and it's just codepink.org on the website or in social media. You can find us at Code Pink. And the other is a new coalition we put together called peaceinukraine.org, the hashtag peaceinukraine. So either of those ways. And if people want to find out where there are rallies or flyering happening in their communities, they can find that on the peaceinukraine.org website.
Thank you, Medea. Before we have to say goodbye, your final thoughts?
Well, you know, people are always waiting for somebody else to do something. And now is the time to stop waiting for that. If you are watching TV and agonized by the scenes that you see, if you are hearing a lot of propaganda about war that you find does not serve the interest of peace, you know, now is the time to get out. And when we say get out, it doesn't have to be a large group. You can go out with three or four of your friends and start educating people. You can be calling your member of Congress or be calling the White House. If they don't hear from us, they will continue and the war will drag on. So I say, you know, the movement is up to us. We are that movement. If we don't build it here in the United States, this dangerous, militaristic country that we live in, that has been waging wars all over for decades now, will continue to be a threat to world peace. So let's stop the Russians and let's stop our own country from doing these kind of horrific invasions in our name.
Medea Benjamin, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Thank you for your past leadership and Code Pink, and thank you for being on the show. You take it easy.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Medea.
Nice being on with you. Let's build this movement. Thank you for the time.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Taught from a very young age that one of the many blessings of living in an open and democratic nation is that we have the right to say publicly anything that's on our mind, that free speech is one of the great hallmarks of our democracy. And yet, throughout our nation's history, there have been periods of time when the constitutional guarantee of free speech has been under serious assault. And this is one of those times. Less than 50% of students, as well as all other American adults, feel the right of free speech is fully secure in America today. And I'm afraid they're correct. In recent years, a number of public opinion surveys have disclosed that a goodly number of Americans believe people with hateful or very controversial views that might unduly excite people or insult people should not be allowed to express those views in the public arena. And this is true of both liberals and conservatives. At least one in four college students think it's fine to ban overly controversial speakers from their college campuses. And in fact, one in six students believe that if all else fails, to do so by resorting to physical intervention to prevent them speaking on campus is just fine. Well, as the old adage about it not being legally permissible to shout fire in a crowded movie theater, beyond that, what are the limits of free speech today? Should racist speech be allowed? How about misogynist speech or pro-Palestinian and anti-Israeli speech? Does the fact that our nation is very divided, very tribal today, inform the answers to such questions? Well, we've got a lot to cover today, so let's get to it. And happily, we could not have a better guest for this topic than attorney Nadine Strossen. Attorney Strossen is the New York Law School's John Marshall Professor of Law Emerita. From 1991 until 2008, she served as the president of the American Civil Liberties Union, the first woman to do so. When she stepped down as ACLU president in 2008, three U.S. Supreme Court justices participated in her farewell and tribute luncheon: Ruth Bader Ginsburg, David Souter, and Antonin Scalia. Her 2018 book is Hate: Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. And her earlier book, Defending Pornography, Free Speech, Sex, and the Fight for Women's Rights, was named a Notable Book of 1995 by the New York Times. Nadine Strossen, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm delighted to be here, Jim. Thank you and Michael so much for having me as your guest.
Okay, let's look at some of the current controversies concerning the limits of speech. Nadine Strossen, you've written a book entitled Hate: Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech. Given our nation's strong belief in freedom of speech, should speech that, well, many members of society might consider hateful be censored or punished? Is hate speech beyond the pale?
Not all hate speech is beyond the pale. Some is constitutionally protected and some is constitutionally punishable. And that's what I think is a really missing important point in the constant debate, Jim, because people will make equally false claims that hate speech is unprotected. We often hear that. But we also often hear hate speech is absolutely protected. Our Constitution draws a very sensible line. And when I say the Constitution, that's not really quite accurate. I should say the Supreme Court's case law, modern case law, interpreting the Constitution, going back to the middle of the 20th century, so it's quite old now, says that government may never punish speech solely because of disagreement with, even strong disapproval, loathing, condemnation of the viewpoint of the speech, no matter how hateful that viewpoint is, no matter how hated that viewpoint is, the appropriate response is for us to raise our voices to refute it, to rebut it, if we choose to be more, it might be more strategic in a particular circumstance to ignore it, but in other words, not to call on the power of government to pick and choose which ideas are beyond the pale, to use your phrase. However, if you look beyond the message of the speech, its content, and you look at it in its overall context, the Supreme Court has rightly said that speech, if in particular facts and circumstances, it directly threatens certain specific, serious, imminent harm, then the speech can be punished. And speech with much different content, including hateful content, often satisfies that what's often called the emergency concept. And the Supreme Court has recognized several subcategories of speech that satisfy the emergency concept, including true threats, targeted harassment or bullying, intentional incitement of imminent lawless or violent conduct. And we can all think of many examples of hateful speech that satisfy those appropriately strict but not impossible standards and can be punished. But when we go beyond that, Jim, and we go back to the earlier days before the Supreme Court was so speech protective, it used what many other countries still use, the so-called bad tendency test. Speech did not have to have such a tight and direct causal connection to harm to be punished, as long as it had a bad tendency that it might at some future point perhaps potentially lead to some danger in the future, it could be censored and punished. Well, basically, all speech satisfies that broad and vague standard, and in particular, any speech that is politically unpopular. So it may be counterintuitive, but I think it's really important for people to understand that for those of us, certainly including myself, who advocate equal justice and equality and human rights and dignity, especially for racial and gender and other groups that have historically been marginalized, we have the most to lose from censorship and the most to gain from robust free speech, because it is our advocacy and advocacy of our forebears that have constantly been censored under the looser bad tendency test. And in other countries that do still enforce that loose standard under the guise of hate speech laws that are designed to protect vulnerable minority groups, the speech of those minority groups tends to be disproportionately censored.
Nadine, what about campus codes that give a college the right to limit the speech or actions of a group whose political platform and rhetoric on campus is deeply upsetting to some students, such as anti-Israeli actions or speeches on a college campus that's deeply upsetting to some of the campus's Jewish students? And in this regard, are the limits of free speech different on a college campus than in the public square?
Michael, on a public university campus, a government institution, the standard, same standards of the First Amendment apply as apply in any other public space. If we're talking about a private sector university, then the First Amendment itself does not directly apply. But most private universities choose, as a matter of their own institutional values, voluntarily to comply with the same freedom of speech and academic freedom standards that they would be required to adhere to if they were public institutions under the First Amendment. In fact, the Supreme Court has often said, and it's been observed by political and cultural and social commentators, educators, among others, that freedom of speech is especially important on our nation's campuses, given that they have a special mission to pursue truth through research, through teaching, through scholarship, through publication. Now, academic freedom is a little bit different from freedom of speech insofar as there are certain areas of campus that are designed for a particular mission, let's say a laboratory or a classroom or a library, and logically, again, the First Amendment law is nothing but logical. One, restraints on speech that are designed to promote the particular mission of that particular forum are completely appropriate. So I've been a law professor for many years. In my law classes, I have a free speech right, if I were a citizen out on the public square, to pontificate about anything, but I have a professional responsibility in my role as a law professor in front of a class to self-censor, right, to only talk about what the subject is, to instill in my students the responsibility that their answers have to be grounded on analysis and citation to precedents and constitutional provisions and not just be grounded on their emotions, let's say. So these are restrictions on speech that would not be tolerated if government were imposing them in the public sphere. But in an academic setting, we want to have viewpoint-neutral restraints on speech that will further the specific academic mission of the institution. Then there are, every campus should and does have places that are the equivalent of the town square. They're usually big open malls on a campus where literally anybody can say anything, as they could in any other public park.
And Nadine, you were quoted, maybe it's a couple of months ago now, time flies, in the Daily Beast, an article about a free speech forum held at Yale Law School that, well, it didn't end well. I wonder if you can explain for our listeners what happened at that free speech forum and whether these kinds of incidents are happening more and more frequently on our college campuses.
Yes, and I'm so happy to describe what happened at Yale precisely because it is typical. It is not at all an outlier. And it's particularly ironic because, as you indicate, the purpose of the forum was to promote free speech, to exemplify civil discourse, in particular between two accomplished lawyers who are working with organizations that have very different perspectives on many important legal issues, but strongly agree on certain legal issues, including a recent Supreme Court decision that was very positive in terms of students' free speech rights and other people's free speech rights on campus. And so these two lawyers, one representing the American Humanist Association, a secular humanist organization, and the other representing Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a Christian conservative organization, we're going to talk about how there are matters of common concern that can bind people to where it's strategically wise to pool your efforts and your resources to jointly advocate for particular causes that are beneficial to both of you, and put aside for that moment your disagreement about other issues. I should say that I have participated in that kind of forum many, many times in my life. I used to do it regularly with the late Justice Antonin Scalia. He and I became good friends through that kind of exchange, and I found it extremely productive. But it was heartbreaking that in this instance, when the very senior, respected Yale Law School professor, Kate Stith, began to introduce the forum, she was disrupted by dozens and dozens, I forget the exact number, but, you know, dozens for sure, of law students in that forum shouting insults at her, shouting insults at, in particular, the Alliance Defending Freedom speaker. And Professor Stith gave them several warnings. They ultimately left the classroom where this event was going to take place, and it ultimately proceeded in the remaining amount of time. But the students continued to disrupt so loudly out in the hall, banging on walls, continuing to shout, that not only was it hard for people inside this classroom to hear each other, but a faculty meeting that was taking place, you know, elsewhere in the building had to be moved online because the noise was so disruptive, and at least one or two other classes were also subject to disruption. To add insult to injury, there was no disciplinary action taken against these disruptors, despite the fact that they were violating Yale's very clear standards of conduct, that kind of disruptive protest is violating the free speech rights of not only the speakers, but of the members of the audience who wanted to hear the speakers. But, you know, if rules aren't enforced, then there becomes more of an incentive for them to be broken the next time around. The other really classic, and everything that I'm saying about the Yale incident, unfortunately, is all too typical. The other way in which it was both unfortunate and typical is that the students who were disruptively protesting and their allies made the argument that, oh, they were just exercising their own free speech rights. The answer is not so. You certainly have a right to engage in peaceful, non-disruptive protest. I and the ACLU ardently defend that right. But when you cross the line into preventing a willing speaker to speak to willing audience members, you are interfering with other people's free speech rights. In particular, factual circumstances, reasonable people might disagree. You know, is shouting for 5 minutes too much? Does it only cross the line at 10 minutes? But I think if you look at the video of this incident and hear the reports that were made, even long after the students had left that room, of how much speech and how much academic discourse and faculty governance they interfered with, that was a violation of free speech, the antithesis of what they claim an exercise of free speech.
Nadine, the disruptive action at Yale that you've just spoken about was caused, in this case, in the main, by liberal students who took exception to the conservative participant at the forum. And once upon a time, I think, based on my own reading of history, tell me if I'm wrong, it might have been conservative students very upset about some buddy they thought was liberal, too radical coming to their campus to speak. And it probably, though, in that case, might not have actually resulted in kind of the physical shouting and shutting down of the forum. I wonder your thoughts on this and the matter of whether or not the overall fractious political climate that exists in the country, the tribalism that exists in the country today, it doesn't perhaps explain that.
Jim, if one looks both at history and around the country, one sees that, sadly, there are examples of liberals trying to deplatforming conservatives, but also vice versa. This is,
sure.
And you know, I think I know the conservative media have done a much better job of publicizing the incidents when their folks are the ones that are shouted down. And that's really unfortunate because it lessens the result that I think we need if we're going to end this kind of fractiousness and tribalism, to use your fine words. And that is that everybody has to understand that no matter who they are, no matter what they believe, they have an equal stake in making sure that these neutral principles of free speech and access to ideas, as long as it doesn't cross the line to, you know, creating an emergency, intentional incitement of imminent violence or bullying or so forth, that you, just because the idea is controversial, even if the idea is loathed or loathsome, and, you know, whether it's an idea of the right or the idea on the left, the underlying principle is exactly the same. And that's why those of us who defend free speech for civil rights protesters, for Black Lives Matter protesters, have a stake in also defending free speech for those who advocate exactly the opposite. And you better believe that we have seen calls around the country for Black Lives Matter to be censored as hate speech, as terrorist speech, as extremist speech. That's coming from government officials in many parts of the country. Conversely, we hear calls coming from different part of the political spectrum that Blue Lives Matter advocacy is hate speech, or All Lives Matter advocacy is hate speech. None of it should be punished as hate speech. All of it should be subject to discussion, debate, refutation, argumentation. Let's battle it out on campuses and in other public forums. Let's not resort to the coercive tactic of censorship.
Nadine, you were the head of the ACLU for many years. You're a law professor now. And as we all know, there's been recently in the United States a surge in book banning in public school systems. Now, there's always been disputes over what books parents and school boards think are appropriate to be part of the school curriculum or in the school library. But why do you think this historical repudiated practice of book banning is on the rise today?
Michael, it's a really important point. Last week I spoke to the Texas Library Association Convention, and Texas has the dubious honor of leading the nation in book banning. And apparently what happened was somebody got a hold of a list of books that were recommended for DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and a member of the state legislature wrote to every school and school library in the state, and with this list of 850 books, essentially pressuring them to get rid of the books. I mean, but this too, going back to Jim's prior point, also comes from the left. From the left, where you're constantly hearing pressures to get Huckleberry Finn or To Kill a Mockingbird or Of Mice and Men out of school libraries and out of school curricula because they object to the racist attitudes and language that are described in those books. I think certainly not endorsed, but so the school. I think the reason that the school battles have heated up, Michael, is what Jim talked about generally, and that is the increased tribalism, that everything is turning into a political battle, and you have to choose what side you're on, what team you're on. Evidence indicates that people don't just consider the ideas of their ideological counterparts to be wrong. They consider them to be evil, and they don't want their kids to date somebody of a different political party. So, you know, talking about hate, I think the hatred on the basis of political ideology is at least as pronounced a problem in our society as hatred on other identity factors.
You know, Nadine, I confess to being particularly upset when it's folks on the left or purported liberals or progressives who try to shut down speech they don't like because it's insensitive, it's not politically correct, it's hateful from their point of view, et cetera, et cetera. And it upsets me particularly because my understanding of the history around this issue is that when the government suppresses speech, when they or suppresses, you know, public action protesting anything that's going on in the government, they're not generally quickest to come down on right wingers who are engaging in that kind of speech or that kind of protest, but they come down more quickly on the anti-government, more liberal, more progressive speech. I'm thinking of what happened in the 60s around the anti-Vietnam War movement. Am I right about that?
You raised that in a prior question, and I brought it up to date, and I didn't go into details in the history, but, you know, during the Red Scare and during McCarthyism, and certainly during the Vietnam era, and, you know, many other periods in our history, it's been professors and students and others who were suspected of being socialists or communists or pacifists or anti-war dissidents, you know, not to mention the bans, the speaker bans that many southern universities imposed against speakers from the civil rights movement. This is why, Jim and Michael, I'm constantly trying to teach a little bit of history to the students that I speak to today, because when they understand how potent a weapon censorship was against the until strikingly recently against the very causes that they hold so dear, that really gives them pause when they understand that great heroes of civil rights and gay rights and women's rights have all been adamantly opposed to censorship. It gives them a different perspective.
And Nadine, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you as we conclude, how can our listeners follow your work, and how can they get in touch with the ACLU?
But ACLU, very easy. Just look at the ACLU website. If you Google ACLU, it's got tremendously useful resources and accessible information. For yours truly personally, I haven't organized a personal website, but if you Google my name, you'll get zillions of YouTube videos of various presentations I've made. One thing that I'm particularly proud of is I've been doing a series of blog posts for FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, answering the most common arguments that are made against free speech and the most common questions about free speech. I'm up to about number 25 at this point, and I think those who are interested in the topic that you kindly have both discussed with me today would find those blog posts particularly interesting.
Well, Dean Strassen, as always, it's wonderful to hear from you. I would encourage our listeners to do what you suggest. I've listened to some of those. They're wonderful. You've been wonderful with us today, and we sure thank you for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Nadine.
Thank you both, Jim and Michael. I really look forward to talking with you again.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.